Today's reading is from Luke. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be a guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is the son of Abraham. For the Son of Man come out to seek and save the lost." The word of God for the people of God.
Great job, Audrey. Well, that's a story that many of us are familiar with. You saw even the children's moment. They raised their hand. They knew. Once he said, "climbs up in the tree." Many of you probably learned the song when you were a kid, right? How's it go? Zacchaeus was a little man, and a wee little man was he. Right? Oh, you can stop. We're not going to do a whole sing-along. But right there, I mean, just that line, "a wee little man," we're introduced to the topic of vulnerability. Guys, show of hands, how many of you would like to be called or known as a wee little man? None of us. And yet that's what Zacchaeus had to live with. I mean, throughout centuries now, that's how he's known. Gosh, can you imagine the vulnerability? And so it raises the question for us, right off the gate, what do we do with our vulnerability? Because a lot of us do what Zacchaeus did. Zacchaeus covered up his vulnerability with the trappings of power, with authority over others. That was how he dealt with being a wee little man. It reminds me of the Wizard of Oz. You know, the first time in that story when we encounter the Wizard of Oz is huge, all-powerful, all-knowing Oz. And yet by the end of the movie, after Dorothy and her friends do everything Oz tell them to do, that's when they discover that Oz is really not this big facade, but is actually a man. A normal man who is hiding behind a curtain and pushing all the levers. It's an image that is stuck in our world, in our community. We talk about peeking behind the curtains and being disappointed with what we see, or being afraid lest someone peek behind our curtains. Inside all of us, there is a wee little man, a little child, this controlling the levers of our hearts and our actions, and particularly when we feel threatened, that little child's in control. We all experience vulnerability. When you think about it, every time there's a power play, someone trying to establish dominance, either by asserting the power of their position, that they're higher up in the pecking order, the hierarchy, than you are, or they're trying to show how much they know or demonstrate their competence, that they're better at something. Anytime that authority is being expressed, there's an insecurity, a vulnerability beneath it. We all experience vulnerability, some of us in small ways and sometimes in significant ways. Just this last week, I went to a restaurant. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd worked through the lunch hour with a couple meetings, but I was hungry. I didn't have anything to church. And I didn't feel like going through a drive-through, so I went to a restaurant. And when I went in, I was alone. I sat at a table. I instantly felt vulnerable, because when you're sitting in a very public place by yourself, you feel alone. So what do you think I did? I pulled out my phone. How many of you done that, right? I pulled out my phone and I was like, well, I'll do a couple emails, I'll do this, and then I had a pad of paper and a pen, and I thought, well, I'll just look busy, and that way no one's gonna feel sorry for this guy eating by himself, and I'm working, and finally, you know, the food came, and when the food came, that's when I finally looked up and I saw there were three other people in the restaurant who were just like me, working by themselves, sitting by themselves, and every single person had a computer open or a tablet or some kind of technology in front of them. They were doing work while they ate. And that's not to say that the work was bad or, you know, that there wasn't even a need to do the work, but I can say, at least for myself, in that moment, the decision to pull out my phone was not driven by work that had to get done. It was because I was making a choice that it was better to look busy than to look lonely. I was covering up my vulnerability with some degree of authority, right? And this plays itself out in small ways, but sometimes in significant ways as well. Take, for example, the work of police officers. This is an example that Andy Crouch makes in his book, Strong and Weak, and I should add that many of the concepts in this sermon and last week's and next week's are based off of this book. He uses the example of police work, and it's interesting, he wrote this months, years before we arrived in our present moment today, but it's very appropriate. He says, you know, police officers face a high degree of vulnerability. It's just part and parcel of their work. They are exposed to risk. This past week, we did training as a church staff about lots of different incidents that could happen and how we would respond in an emergency. And there was a member of the Indianapolis Police Force who came and did the training with us. And he started talking through all the different possible scenarios. And just sitting in that room as he talked about what could happen, every single one of us instantly felt vulnerable, afraid. And he was trying to walk us through how we should respond. And he said it at least a dozen times, it's okay if you just take care of yourself, if you just get yourself to safety. That is an okay choice. It's not guilty. But then he would always contrast that. He says, but we are equipped. Police officers, we are called. We have a mandate. We are a sworn duty to run the opposite direction from the rest of the crowd, to enter into the moment of danger, to bear that vulnerability and protect others. And I thought to myself after that training, man, there's not many jobs I know of where there's that kind of risk inherent in the job. So to go with that vulnerability, they have all kinds of authority. That authority comes from their training, from the equipment and weapons they carry, to the position they hold. And as the risks get higher and higher, they're more and more vulnerable in today's world, well then it's natural for a police officer to desire more and more authority to protect themselves and to protect the community. But this is the rub, isn't it? Because there are communities that feel exposed by that authority, who feel vulnerable and we're stuck. So is there a way forward? How do we resolve this tension? Well, interestingly enough, I think the story of Zacchaeus can help us, but you have to stick with me a little ways to get there. You see, authority and vulnerability, we think of them as polar opposites, but they're not. Last week, we talked about what happens if you put them on a 2x2 grid, and the way the picture changes, that it is very possible for us to have authority and to suffer vulnerability at the same time. As the example I just gave, that's what police officers do every single day. And when we do that appropriately, human beings flourish. I mean, and that can be hard to kind of get our minds around. What does it look like when we flourish? But let me give you this example. If you were to watch me shooting basketball in the backyard, you would see that I have no authority when it comes to basketball. I'm standing on a stool for that picture to even get that close to the hoop. It's all vulnerability. If you were to watch me, it would be painful for you. But by the same token, there's the all-star, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, the all-star game. And on the court, at any all-star game, there's this collection of talent and skill. Those men, those players, have incredible authority when it comes to the game of basketball. No one plays it or knows it at a higher level than them. And yet, how many of you watch the all-star game? Exactly. No hands went up. I don't know anyone who watches more than just a few minutes of it. Why? Because there's no vulnerability. No one plays defense. No one cares what the final score is. There's nothing to lose. It's when those things come together, when it's the playoffs or the championships, that you see incredible skill, but also mixed together with that possibility of loss. That's worth watching. That's what brings the best out in us. That's when we flourish. But when authority and vulnerability get separated, that's when we get distortions. That's when we become less than what God intended us to be. You can have someone who has all authority and no vulnerability. That's exploiting. Or someone who has all vulnerability and no authority, no capacity to change it. That's suffering. And along those two, between those quadrants, Andy Crouch, he makes an axis. He says, this is the axis of the false choice. He doesn't define the false choice, but here's the way I define it. The false choice is what Zacchaeus did. It's what the Wizard of Oz did. It's what we do anytime we hide our vulnerability behind a wall of authority. We're making a false choice because we think by doing that, that we're going to protect ourselves, that we're going to, you know, we don't want to feel vulnerable. We don't want to be wounded. We don't want to risk loss, so we hide behind our authority. But the thing is the vulnerability we cast off, someone else bears. Andy Crouch calls this the law of conservation, that when we get rid of vulnerability, it's not like it disappears into thin air. Someone else, somewhere else, bears it. There is a line between exploiting and suffering. The two fit together. The closest I've ever come to this in my own personal experience is when Jamelyn and I moved to Haiti for the first time. We were newlyweds. We were, you know, very naive and young. And in fact, when we moved to Haiti, for me, it was the first time that I'd ever been to the country. Jamelyn had been once before. But when she went with a large group. There was a guide to kind of take her through everything. There was a group to insulate her a little bit and help her feel protected. When we went just the two of us, we felt very vulnerable and exposed. We didn't know the language. We didn't know the customs. When we arrived in Port-au-Prince, I mean, just the heat and the noise and the language, it was like an assault on the senses. We were overwhelmed, very scared. And to top it all off, one of our bags got lost. We had four bags, and those were going to be our possessions for the next two years. And one of those four bags went missing. It never made the transfer in Miami. And we had to look around for it and ask around for it and finally find our way to a table, a desk, where we could fill out some paperwork. By the time we did that, the entire baggage claim area was empty. There was no one around. All the mission teams, all the groups had gotten their stuff and passed on through. So it was just the two of us going through customs. And I'm sure we looked like deer caught in the headlights, you know? We had sitting duck tattooed on our foreheads because the customs agents sized us up instantly. They could see the vulnerability. And in contrast, they had all kinds of authority. They had the position, the uniforms, they knew the laws, they knew the language. More importantly, there were no witnesses, no crowds pushing them through to hurry, no one to see what they were going to do. And so they took their time going through our bags, and they removed anything that had any value to it. Laptop, printer, camera. It was a shakedown. And we knew that whatever price they gave us, we were going to have to pay it if we wanted that stuff. If you go back 2,000 years, that's the kind of power that Zacchaeus had. He had all the authority in the world. He was backed by the whole Roman legal system, by the might of the Roman military, and he could charge whatever price he wanted to all of his neighbors, his entire community. I mean, the Roman government demanded X amount of dollars from him, and he had to collect that from his neighbors, but he could add to it whatever he wanted. And the people had no authority. They were completely vulnerable in that situation. Whatever price he set was exactly what they had to pay, or else there would be dire consequences. He had all kinds of authority, and yet for all that, it didn't take away his vulnerability. Here's the trick. He was still a wee little man. And in fact, the use of his authority to exploit others, it just made him more isolated, more alone in the midst of a crowd, despite all of his success, despite the fact that he was rich. He wasn't flourishing. It's because he was in the grip of an idol. He may not have articulated that way, may not have known he was in the grip of an idol, but that's exactly what was going on in Zacchaeus' heart. See, let me take you back to the story of Genesis, which we spent a little time in last week too. When God creates human beings, he creates us with all kinds of authority. He tells Adam and Eve, you know, tend the garden, care for the trees, name all the animals. He gives them authority, but they're also vulnerable. They're naked. And beyond that, there's a tree that they cannot eat. And if they eat of it, they will surely die. And so God sets a boundary to protect them. But Adam and Eve, you know, probably because of that boundary, are more curious than ever about that fruit. And probably wasn't the first time they passed by it, but one day they're passing by it when a serpent comes down and says, "Come, take this fruit." Eve protests and says, no. The Lord has told us if we eat it, we will surely die. And listen to the serpent's response, because this is the promise of every idol. He says, "You will not die, but you shall be like God." I mean, this is what every idol promises. You will not die. I'll take away your vulnerability, this insecurity, this woundedness you feel. I'll take that away. You will not be hurt, and I'll increase your authority. You shall be like God. You'll acquire power, feelings, ecstasy like you can't imagine. And every idol ever since makes the same promise to us, whether you're talking about affairs and pornography or drugs and alcohol and gambling or work or technology. They always offer a shortcut to power, a shortcut to taking away our vulnerability, but they always fail. Every idol makes the same promise. Every idol follows the same path. And in the beginning, they give you that feeling. They take away that vulnerability, and they don't cost you very much, but over time, an idol delivers less and less of that feeling and benefit, and it demands more and more and more of you, so that at the end, when the idol has you completely where it wants you, you're all vulnerability and no authority over that to which you've given your life. And it's not just yourself that bears that cost. It's the people around you. It's the people who love you. It's the people with whom you share life. You see, one way to know if you're in the grip of an idol is if your relationships are suffering. Because an idol will destroy relationships first and foremost, because it's in relationships where we experience vulnerability and authority together. And an idol will destroy it every time. So I ask you just to think about, how are your relationships these days? Are there more and more people who have authority in your life? Are there more and more places where you can, are there more or less places where you can be vulnerable, can be truly you? If there's less places, then you might just be in the grip of an idol. Zacchaeus certainly was. He had all kinds of riches and success, but for all that success, he's alone. He has no relationships, no one with whom he can be himself, until he hears one day about this Jesus. This Jesus who's coming through that everyone's talking about, and I think at first it's probably curiosity that makes Zacchaeus go towards the parade. But it's more than curiosity, because when he can't see something possesses him, he has to see more, and so he makes this drastic step of climbing up in a tree and going out on a limb. This is a risk for a man like Zacchaeus, someone of his position in the community. Not just any man climbing on the tree, it's childish, but to be a tax collector sitting up there, I mean, he's risking the sniggering of all the crowd, saying, "Oh, look at that wee little man up in the tree." He's taking a risk. And what's beautiful is that Jesus meets him in that risk. And when he meets him, when he sees Zacchaeus with all of his need, what does he offer him? A relationship. He says, "Zacchaeus, come down, for I'm going to your house today." And in making that choice, that invitation, Jesus makes himself vulnerable because he can be rejected. Not just rejected by Zacchaeus, but rejected by the crowd. I mean, no sooner does Jesus choose Zacchaeus than all the crowd begins to grumble. This man is a sinner. Why is Jesus choosing him over us? It's almost as if Jesus is saying, "Hey, Zacchaeus, even if the crowd rejects you, they're going to reject me too, and I'm going to be with you in that vulnerability." And what does Jesus do for the crowd then? Well, he increases their authority because he gives them the choice to reject him, to reject Zacchaeus. They have that option. They have power that they didn't have just a few moments ago. Whenever you're, and this is an important point, whenever you're working with an individual or a community that's in that lower left quadrant, the quadrant of suffering, our instinct is to want to take away their vulnerability, to give them the food, the water, the care that they need. But charity work in and of itself is a dead end, because actually what you want to do is you want to increase their authority, their capacity for meaningful action, their ability to address their own problems in the world. If you don't, then actually what you create is more vulnerability, because you make them dependent on the giver who's in the place of authority and the receiver who's in a place of dependence. So at St. Luke's, we do our best to try to do charity work differently. Our work in the community, we didn't even call it charity. We do English as new language classes. Every Wednesday night, there are people here who are trying to learn a language because they're trying to increase their authority and capacity in this world where we speak English a lot. This coming fall, we're going to start a new program called Getting Ahead. Families and individuals have been interviewing with our outreach team for months preparing for this, and they're going to go through an intense 2-year program to break the cycle of poverty. It's all aimed at increasing their capacity. When we do programs like we did yesterday, or like Angel Tree, even when it's a give out, a handout, we do our best to give people choice, that they get to choose which backpack they want. They get to choose which services they're going to go to. They get to choose their shoes. They get to choose their jeans. We want to give people the dignity of choice, because increasing their capacity, their authority, and their own lives is the end game here. And so Jesus gives the crowd authority. And what you see in this story is Zacchaeus stepping into vulnerability and the people stepping into authority and Jesus meeting them there. And everyone in the end is flourishing in a way that they didn't have at the start. And how do we know they were flourishing? Because relationships are restored. Zacchaeus has friends again. The people are no longer vulnerable to him exploiting them. It's in relationships, healthy relationships, where authority and vulnerability come together, and we cannot flourish without them. And so if we want to take a first step in life, it's to step into relationships, especially with those who might live in a different quadrant of the world than we do. Because in that sharing of perspective, in that sharing of authority and vulnerability, that's where communities flourish. Which gets me back to the question of police officers. You see, one of the challenges, there's been lots of studies kind of put out about this, is that something changed when police officers no longer walked their beat, when they no longer walked the streets and knew the faces and the names of the people they were serving, that there was a relationship that was broken once they simply rode around in the car on their patrol. And when there was that lack of relationship, that disconnect, it got filled with fear and cynicism, and the fear and the cynicism drove people even further apart. So how do you fix that? I got home last week after church, and I was feeling really good about the services and everything, and about my messages, and I turned on the news, and I saw that there was a shooting in Baton Rouge. While we were celebrating here at church, there are 6 officers who were shot, and some, half of whom were killed. And my heart sank, and I thought, oh, here we go again. There's this cycle we're just going to keep going down this path, except something happened to break that cycle. I don't know if it was because of this, but the shooter in that instance was from Kansas. And so in Wichita, Kansas, there was a Black Lives Matter protest planned for that day, later that afternoon. And when the organizers of the protest saw the news, they canceled their protest. And they reached out to the police department and they said, "We want to do something different. Will you join us for a picnic this coming Tuesday?" And so that Tuesday night, protesters and police officers gathered together in a park, and they shared meals together. Police officers grilled out hamburgers and hot dogs. They had bounce houses for kids. They gave horse rides. It was much like kind of the atmosphere we had in our parking lot yesterday, just a community celebration. On top of that, there was vulnerability. The captain of the police force took a Q&A from residents of the community, and he responded to their questions about racial profiling and police practices. But it was the meal that was special. One man, Jarvis Scott, an African-American gentleman, he reported to the newspaper afterward. He said, "I sat down at the table, and there was a Hispanic man and a police officer there, and it was the first time in my life that I've ever sat down with either." Relationships, that's the way forward. Connection, because that's where we experience vulnerability and authority together. They called their picnic First Steps. And to me, that's our call to action today, to take a first step. Because relationships of trust aren't built overnight, but we're called to make a step, to come out from behind our curtain, our wall of authority, and to be vulnerable, to be who God created us to be, and simply offer God's love. Because it's in that intersection of love and risk where we truly flourish. There is no more meaningful action than that. Amen. Our closing hymn this morning actually comes to us from the Hispanic community. It's translated into English, but as you sing these words, just imagine your voices joining together with the communities that wrote them, and know that together in God's kingdom, we are one. Let us stand.